Classic Rock 102.9 MGK. This is going to be a very exciting night for me because on Friday, September 22nd, at the Tower Theater, not only are they showing Monty Python and the Holy Grail, it'll be followed by a Q&A session with this man who's breathing heavily in the background. John Cleese is on the phone. Hello, John.
Hello, John. What a boring lot of names you've got. Stephen, what is it? Steve and
yeah.
Dave.
And Dave.
And John. God, could you get three duller names than that? Don't
well,
forget
okay,
I'm a
it's
John.
Funny you say that.
What happened to names like Max and Wolfgang?
If you'd like some excitement, John, my middle name is Belgo. Stephen Belgo Vassalotti.
Now, let me get this straight. We're taking crap about our names from a man whose real name is John Cheese.
Yes, and I wish it had been left like that. But my dad changed it. You see, he was so fed up with being teased that when he went into the British Army, and this is back in 1915, when, you know, the First World War was over. Uh-huh. So he was his name down with an L instead of the H. He became Reginald Cleese. And I thought, what was this bloody silly thing to do? I mean, if you're going to change your name, change it something proper. You see what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Patterson or Finkelstein or something like that. Why change just... When I went to school, nobody ever called me anything other than Cheese. It was the first thing that came into people's heads. So surely if you're going to change your name, we're going to change it to something silly. He could have called himself Reginald Belgo.
Now, John, we've actually spoken before. I hosted the national radio show for the Holy Grail's 25th anniversary.
Oh, terrific.
Right, and here we are at it once again.
Were you any good?
I was great. You sucked.
Do continue.
But I finally get to ask you some questions beyond Holy Grail. And I want to start really with the beginnings of the group. What was the biggest influence for you guys? Was it the Goons? Was it Beyond the Fringe?
Yeah, the Goons. I don't know if Americans know about them, but there was a radio show in the 50s called The Goons, and it was scripted by a genius called Spike Milligan, and the best performer in it was Peter Sellers, who was the greatest voice man of all time, and we all absolutely adored it. And it was just like Monty Python many, many years later. When we got to school in the morning, that's all anybody talked about was the sketches, and people quoted things, and it was exactly like the response that Python had. But that was a show we all loved. There were other people who influenced us, but that was the key one.
Is Beyond the Fringe one of them?
Well, Beyond the Fringe was the first really funny satire show that we ever had. It was the first time that anyone made fun of the Prime Minister or the Queen. I mean, it's hard to remember these days, but back in the very early 60s and late 50s, you didn't make jokes about the Queen or you didn't impersonate the Prime Minister because it was considered disrespectful. And all that finished with Beyond the Fringe, a wonderful radio show in 63, a stage show in 62. But then our humor came along almost as a reaction to all the political humor. There was satire for about 5 years and everyone got fed up with it. And when the Pythons got together, we knew each other from other shows. We just basically said, let's not do political satire. Let's just be very silly. And we just tried to make each other laugh. That was the whole purpose of these script sessions when we read such stuff. I would just try and make the other ones laugh. We had no idea what our target audience was. And the greatest triumph I ever had was reading out the Cheese Shop sketch. And Michael started to laugh, and he laughed so much he fell off his chair. That's the best moment I ever had.
But what would bring around things like, you know, you can understand, like, the parrot sketch, okay, it makes sense. You can see people sitting around writing that. A guy walks into a shop with his mother in a bag and wants to bury her. What brings that about?
Well, Well, I can tell you about that because it was the 13th show of the third series, and Graham and I were getting bored with Python, and I said to Graham one morning, I can remember this, I said, Bray, I'm bored. He said, so am I. I said, we've only got one more show to do. What are we going to write about? And he said, let's write about something really naughty. And then his eyes lit up because he was a qualified, fully qualified doctor, and he said, something about dead bodies. And so we just went for the worst possible thing. When the guy carries his mother in a sack into the undertaker after attack suggests that they eat her.
Well, the choices are, because these two don't know the bit. The choices are, he walks into the shop and the guy makes him two choices. Right. Is she a burier or a burner?
That's right.
And then there's a third option.
First of all, he checks out if she's a dumper. He says, what do you mean a dumper? He says, you want us to dump her in the Thames. And the guy... Then it's a burner or a burier. It says, you know, the thing about a burner is that it's not such a good idea if she's not quite dead, but it's quick.
Put her in the fire, crackle, crackle, crackle.
Crackle, crackle. That's right. But that was just a deliberate attempt to be naughty, and I'm very proud of it. We sometimes do it. Eric and I do the sketch on the stage, and it's just wonderful because there are usually people in the front row who literally cover their face with their hands.
You know, you have done, over the years, there are small roles that you have done that I just love.
Oh, good. Tell me one.
Okay, the blind guy in Yellow Beard.
Yes, that's funny. Okay.
The sheriff in Silverado was brilliant.
Yeah, that was great fun. That was as much fun as I ever had on a movie because it was full of big stars, you know. Mm-hmm. Danny Glover and Kevin Costner and Kevin Kline and Brian Dennehy. It was absolutely packed with these huge stars. And we used to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning in Santa Fe and go off and learn how to ride little push-button Western Star ponies. It was a great trip there. But I'll tell you two other I thought were very good. I thought that when I did Out of Towners with Steve and Goldie Hawn, I thought that the manager who dressed up in women's clothes and did strange dance routines, I thought that was a very good one. And the other one was Rat Race. I thought Rat Race, that was a really good one.
Oh, God, that's a great one.
The silly teeth in. But not too many people ask me to do comedies. You know, it doesn't happen much these days. And I think I'm just as funny as I used to be. But the trouble is, all movies now are made for young American males, you know, about 19. And those sort of people don't have no interest in anyone over about 40 years of age. So never mind. There's lots of other things to do.
All right. Now, there is one very important role to Dave over here.
He's deferring to the Bond junkie in the room, and that's me. I know you're not a big fan of the Craig-era Bonds due to their lack of British humor.
Well, I'll tell you what happened. It's all economics. What they began to discover a few years ago was that a huge amounts of money were made at the box office in the Far East, in Asia. And, of course, the Asians did not appreciate the little jokes made about the English class system. Why should they? So that tilted the Bond films in the direction of more and more and more action sequences. And the thing about an action sequence, I think it should last about 3 minutes and should be really intense and sort of set the heart a pounding. But if you have an action sequence that lasts about 12 minutes, then kind of that isn't quite right. That's not what an action sequence should be, in my opinion. I just think it should come and go. Otherwise, if it's all at this same high level of action all the time, it just becomes monotonous. I remember going to see my family taking to be one of those... what was those Schwarzenegger films? What was the guy called?
The Terminator. Yeah.
And I watched it halfway through, and in the end, I got so bored, I walked out, and I realized I was walking out in the middle of a fight. See what I mean? So when the action gets predictable and boring, it goes on too long, you know, that's a shame. And the other thing about Bond movies, which I always used to complain about, even when I was in them, was that they used to have good titles like Dr. No and Goldfinger, you know, Spectre. I mean, these are great title. And now they're called, like, Don't Die the Day After Tomorrow, you know? And, which don't mean anything. You see what I mean? And then the other thing is you can never follow the plots anyway. They're so terrified that someone will follow the plot and see what's going to happen that they make them completely incomprehensible. The last one I saw, I was sitting with my son-in-law, Ed Solomon, who wrote Men in Black and Bill and Ted's Adventures, and another screenplay writer. And at the end, I said to them, can either of you follow the plot? And both of them said, no, I have no idea what the plot was. So I thought, well, if these two top Hollywood writers can't follow the plot, who else can? So I think that it's gone in the wrong direction. But the trouble is, money spoils everything. Mm-hmm. And the Bond people have been very clever in a way, because the box office goes up the whole time. And that's what the aim is, you see. Whereas the aim might be to make a better film next time. Yeah.
Was there a plan for Holy Grail? I mean, did you guys, you went in there, you shot it, right? But did you know how all of this stuff was going to connect from, you know, sketch A to sketch B and so on down the line?
No, I think it's fair to say we had no idea what we were doing. We'd wrote some funny sketches, but we didn't know if they would sort of knit together into anything. And it only just works as a story, you know. Whereas Life of Brian, I think, is actually rather a good story. Mm-hmm. I think it's got a beginning, a middle, and an end. I think it's such a really good story. But that was the only time we ever pulled it off. When we tried to do it again with Meaning of Life, we just went back to a sketch show, which I thought was a bit of a shame, a bit of a backward step, although there's great stuff in it, like Mr. Equator. You know.
I've got to tell you, I love Meaning of Life. I love Meeting of Life.
Thank you.
Yeah, I really do. Every one of the sketches is you guys at your height, especially, you know, when you can introduce the machine that goes bing into anything.
Yeah, that's good.
It's going to be a great day.
Very good sketch, and women like that because they love our take on the way that doctors think about pregnancy, you know. But, of course, the reason that sketch was so good is I wrote it with Graham Chapman. Graham had the full medical training, so it was all absolutely observed accurately, you know. But there were things like this First World War thing about clocks being presented, which I never thought was very good. And there was a very bizarre, absurdist thing about fishy. And there's just a number of things in it I don't think were very good. And I think the most interesting thing in movies, believe it or not, is plot. And very, very few people can get it right.
There's another film that you did, and I'm trying to... Clockwise, was that the name of it?
Oh, yeah. Now, that's a very good little movie.
That's a terrific movie. I love that movie.
Terrific movie. Yeah, but the funny thing is, you know, if people are anxious about timekeeping, they can't watch the movie. It makes them too anxious. It's all about a guy who has to get to a place and deliver a huge speech, and now he gets on the wrong train, starts driving across country in a car, and arrives having stolen someone else's suit a minute before the speech. And it's really very, very funny. But as I say, some people just can't watch it because if they are, obsessed with time and always terrified about being late, they just become so anxious watching it that they can't laugh at all.
Now back to Holy Grail for a second. Did you guys have an ending?
No, that's the way why we had to end it, because there wasn't really a story, you see. There wasn't really a story. And in a funny kind of way, when Eric did the musical and wrote Spamalot, the masterstroke was when God gives them a task, it's to put a musical on Broadway. And that enabled it to sort of really be developed in the right way and have a proper ending. But we never had that. So it sort of just, it kind of peters out in a very silly way, which I quite like. But the bit before it is so Gilliam. It's lots of images. And you know, very beautiful images and lots of sound and not very funny. And I think that that's why I love the first hour of Holy Grail. And I don't think the rest of it is anything like as good. But that's so much fun, because when we talk about it on stage, we can argue about that. And people can say whether they think it works or not. They are a bit surprised when I walk straight out and say, I don't think it's very good.
Now, but and speaking of, as long as we're talking about the ending, let's go to the beginning. Who came up with the idea for the credits? I think I may have seen Holy Grail the very first night it opened in America. And you're sitting there, and it's like, you know, this is, and then all of a sudden the credits start to have a fight with themselves.
That's right. Well, I think that that was all written. I'm not sure if this is right, but I believe it was all written at the very last moment by Michael Palin. It's one of the best things he ever did. It's all about, what is it, mooses or elks?
Yeah, elks, and my sister was once touched by a moose. I mean, it just goes, it just totally falls apart, right? And then it becomes this sort of like 1950s intermission, right, kind of graphics happen. It is just too much.
Right.
I've got to tell you, John, whenever I feel at a creative low, if things aren't going for me right, I can't write anything, I can't get anything done, I will sit down and watch Holy Grail, and it rejuvenates me each and every time.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I find that there's certain things, and the loveliest thing that ever happened was a guy in New Zealand wrote to me, and he said he's had depression for about 4 years. And he watched, actually it wasn't a Monty Python, now I come to think of it, it was a 40 Towers. And he said he watched 3 40 Towers, and afterwards he just sat there and he thought, I'm not going to be depressed again. And he wasn't. And I think once he said, wonderful thing about Python is the world is completely absurd. And somebody once said about Python that he could never watch the news after he'd watched Monty Python because he couldn't take it seriously. And I think that's a very healthy attitude. And there are all these news items about, you know, 122 people drowned today when a ferry went down in Bangladesh. Well, you know, I'm sorry, folks. Accidents happen. It's not necessarily either news or very significant. It certainly is for the people involved. It's a tragedy for them, but this is happening all the time. There are accidents all the time. I want to have a BBC death program, and the only thing they talk about is accidents and catastrophes. And there's a clock on the wall behind them that is clocking up the number of deaths and adding them all together.
We now cut to Slow, where a woman got run over with her pram.
That's right. That's right. And this man, here is a photograph of the man who was hit by the taxi when he was cycling. And he's got 2 broken arms and 3 broken legs. But it looks as though he's going to pull through. Meanwhile, 2 trains crashed in India, killing 58 people. Oh, sorry, 59 people, sorry, behind the justice. So, you know, what I mean is, these are personal tragedies, and they're terrible for the people concerned, and not news.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they've become news. That's the other thing that has become news, is people using the wrong word. Here we have a world with Trump in charge, Putin having his political opponents killed, and Erdogan, or whatever his name is in Turkey, is a complete dictator. We have disasters all over the place, and nobody talks about anything important anymore because it's all so crazy. So I think Python is a good antidote. It reminds you just to don't take it all too seriously. It's always been like this. Stop worrying and have a drink and a bit of a giggle.
Did you guys think when this show came to the States, did you think it would fly in America?
No, absolutely not. We had a guy come to London once from WGBH, you know, the great PBS program in Boston, and he came and he said he'd heard it was one show and he wanted to meet us, and he sat in the room and we watched 2 episodes, and when the lights came up after the 2nd episode, he looked as though he had seen a ghost. He was almost unable to speak. He could see his career being dismembered if he ever had anything to do with any of us. And he sort of staggered out of the room and muttered goodbye and went back to Boston and forgot all about it and got married and lived happily ever after. But the point was, he saw in his own mind's eye what would happen to his career if he put Python on. And so everyone was very anxious about putting it on until a lovely guy who ran the PBS station in Dallas, of all places, called Ron DeVilliers, just thought to hell with it. He put it out one night. All his pals who ran PBS stations rang him the next day. They said, did they burn the station down? Did they stone you on the way to work? And Ron said, no, there's been no bad reaction. They all said, what? And put it on the next day themselves. But everybody was terrified of touching it until that moment.
Oh, my Lord. Well, John Cleese will be at the Tower Theater, and we'll be showing Monty Python and the Holy Grail. And afterwards, John and I will be on stage together, and honor, I will come with coconut shells in hand.
And without people with boring names like Steve and Dave.
We'll stay home. Belgo will be there, though.
Belgo will show up.
Belgo will be in the front row waving the Belgian flag.
He right. will, indeed.
If Belgians have a flag, do the Belgians have a flag?
I don't know. I'm Italian.
I don't know. Just has a giant waffle on it. Tickets are available through Ticketmaster.com. John, I look forward to seeing you on the 22nd.
Dude, that's really a waffle thin.
Waffle thin with ya. Now go away before I taunt you a second time.
All right, I'm off. Lauren, tell these people to go away.